From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, we'll meet several Milwaukee doctors who are looking at why some urban physicians burn out while others stay in the field.
Then how the early professional and political life of Abraham Lincoln gave rise to the man we know as the Great Emancipator.
Lincoln said, "I used to be a slave," and it meant something deeply personal to him, and it goes to the heart of his politics and what he would become and how he would grapple with the issue of slavery.
And contributor Melinda Meyer says it's not too early to start preparing your garden, really.
This time of year, we're going to start things like perennials, cool season annuals like pansies, calendulas, snapdragons, and we'll start those now.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. We have reported before on the issue of doctor shortages, especially in already underserved areas like the inner city. Many efforts are underway to attract new doctors to practice in these places, efforts like UW's Triumph program, training in urban medicine and public health.
But recruiting new doctors is only part of the equation. Another part is retaining the ones already in practice. There are studies that show more than 60% of family practice physicians in general experience burnout symptoms, and the numbers are even higher when you look at doctors working in underserved areas.
Several Milwaukee doctors are trying to get to the root of what causes some doctors to leave the profession and what keeps others motivated to stay. Doctors Ann Getson and Shersty Knox are physicians with Aurora Family Medicine's residency program, and Deb Simpson is director of the medical education programs for Aurora Healthcare. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
So we've heard about the dearth of physicians, or at least the significant shortage of physicians in underserved urban areas. How does physician retention compare to the challenges in attracting new physicians to serve these communities in the first place?
They're both challenges. I think that there are a lot of people who are well-intentioned and excited, and it's very meaningful for them to practice in underserved settings. And then we get out there, and it's hard. And burnout is intense across all fields of specialties, but I think it's particularly concentrated in underserved settings because of the unique obstacles that are faced. And so that was obviously one of the questions that we looked at in wanting to do our research about what keeps physicians in underserved settings going, because there are people who are doing it and feel sustained and resilient and find true meaning in what they're doing, and they keep going. So what is it about them that allows us to keep going? And so then how do we train those residents and trainees to develop those skills so they can keep following that goal and that purpose of why they went into medicine in the first place.
So when it comes to retention, how do you go about studying then how the factors that go into some people choosing to stay and some people choosing to leave, or choosing to stay but still feeling burned out?
Well, at least the approach that we took in our study, we wanted to identify people who were successful in staying. We had a minimum number of years that they had to be in practice, a minimum amount of clinical work strictly, to try to really focus on these are the docs who are in the community every day and they've stuck it out for X amount of time. So we tried to narrow it down and got referrals in there. And then we sat down, found those doctors who said, yep, I do feel pretty good about my position. And we sat down and had interviews with them about what is it that keeps you going.
Well, and so let me ask you this. What is it that keeps them going?
Yes. Like many complex phenomenon, it's multifactorial. There are a lot of different components. And when we sat back and looked at all of the information, maybe being physicians, we're naturally inclined to break it down anatomically. So we looked at some kind of external foundational elements, basically being the legs of a person holding you up, that you have support from the healthcare system you're working in, you work within a functional team, you have good work-life balance. But some of the other critical components, the heart of it, why did you go into medicine? A lot of times social justice or health equity and working towards those goals is critically important for these doctors. And there were also some really interesting components of the brain part of it, cognitive processing, reframing challenges as rewarding, and developing resiliency through those kinds of approaches were also really important. And then finally, we kind of identified a specific skill set or toolbox that you can use that help you work with specific populations that have higher rates of distrust of the healthcare system, lower health literacy, and other major social determinants of health.
How do these kinds of answers jibe with the your own kind of lived experiences in the field?
I would say that they're very congruent, that having that purpose and that meaning of why you're doing your job every day is a really, really important driving factor. And it's important to be around other people that share that with you and that help sustain that piece, as well as being able to find victories where it might initially appear as though there aren't any. So sometimes it's even as simple as a difficult patient case saying, well, they came to me today. They did come to clinic, and I was able to talk with them, and maybe we'll work on making more concrete next steps in a treatment plan or identifying solutions to whatever problem you're facing with them. But even just saying they showed up in clinic, that's the first step. And being able to frame your experience in clinic in that positive way.
Kjersti and I are both graduates of the Triumph program. And so we benefited from the experience of having a community of people who share that passion and share those values with you as you go through your medical training. And that was hugely beneficial for me in my development as a physician to connect with people who saw it and shared that excitement, and also were there to help kind of buoy you as those harder times inevitably come as well. I did want to bring up a quote because I think it really illustrates what some of the challenges are. Rachel Remen is a physician who works a lot in humanism in medicine. And we talk about humanism rounds as a way to connect and with each other as colleagues and find meaning in medicine. And she talks, one of her quotes is the expectation that we can be immersed in suffering and loss daily and not be touched by it is as unrealistic as expecting to be able to walk through water without getting wet. We face tremendous grief and challenges as well as sharing a lot of joy with our patients. And I think that community helps us keep that heart lit and going forward.
Well, and so not everyone obviously practicing in a setting like this has gone through a program like Triumph. And so, you know, the various aspects of the toolkit that you talk about might not have been part of their training. What are the implications of this research for people who are mid-career, even early career, but who might not come into the field with this kind of background that a training in urban medicine would have given them?
I think that's one of the challenges that many, in fact, of our residents, particularly at Aurora St. Luke's and Aurora Sinai, face, because the challenges of those populations are also difficult, whether you're in family medicine or obstetrics or radiology. They all feel that same pressure. The critical part is that I think nationally there is recognition that all physicians are being challenged by these elements, and there are starting to be requirements to incorporate things like how do you support patients and yourselves around health disparities? How do you work with patients who have transportation challenges? Curriculum that have been established, and that's part of what I work on. Kjersti's just published an article on a wonderful longitudinal curriculum to train all residents in family medicine that supports them in a longitudinal fashion, not just a week and a lecture here and a topic there.
Is there a certain, I don't know if the term cyclical is right, but is there a certain cyclical aspect to this that, you know, the nature of the physician shortage exacerbates these circumstances that make it, you know, more difficult to keep people, like the idea that there are already fewer people in the field, which puts more pressure on the people who are in the field, which in turn makes more people want to leave the field?
I think that very much can be the case, and I think it goes back to what Anne already said about the importance of the cohort, about being with a group of people or feeling that you have that support of people doing this with you, walking this with you, so that you aren't feeling like you're the only one responsible for solving what you see or what you hear from your patients. And I know from my perspective working in the clinic that knowing that I have community partners, that I have clinic partners, that I have system partners that are all looking at these various challenges from different perspectives helps me feel like I'm not alone and that I can keep going forward. And that's one of the things we really try to also instill in the students and in the residents as we're teaching.
I think we are in a time in healthcare that's a crisis that everyone writes about. But if you look at the notion of electronic health records, for example, information technology, that is taking physicians away from the thing that supports their meaning, which is the direct contact with patients and or their team members. So you IM an instant message your team member instead of talking with them for that moral support. There's a distancing effect along with all the other healthcare challenges about lack of reimbursement, the incentives they all have to do, the number of throughputs versus caring for populations. Those are not cyclic. That's a current state of our healthcare situation that is exacerbating physicians' commitment to their practices.
I don't think it's the physician shortage in and of itself that causes more physicians' shortage. It's those systemic factors that are creating this crucible where family physicians, primary care docs, and physicians across the board are struggling and suffering and having burnout. And then that decreases the desire to go into those fields. You look at family docs, and the majority of them don't want their children to follow that career path. And I think that's an alarming statistic.
And that has not always been the case, right? I mean, you hear a lot about physicians who are the children of other physicians.
Absolutely.
Well, what was the biggest eye-opener for you as you conducted these interviews?
I think one of the more exciting threads that we pulled out of this that we can keep following is thinking about the concept of developing skills in cognitive reframing. How do we approach the stressors that are happening? We're not going to fix the system immediately. It's going to take time to make that better. So what do we do with ourselves in the meantime? Historically, the wellness conversation has been take better care of yourself, get more sleep, eat more healthily. But that's challenging because that's still putting it on the individual physician. You're just not doing well enough taking care of yourself and making yourself well. And so identifying that there are specific skills like reframing cognitive techniques, seeing your values through the lens of the stressors you're facing, or practicing mindfulness meditation to help break the physiologic stress response that you're having are really exciting paths that we can follow to enhance and grow and train our resilience as doctors.
A very concrete example came from one of your interviews, which was a very complex patient with lack of resources, no income, no medication abilities. And that's the cognitive reframing that Anne is talking about, the complexity of, so I can't use the normal things in my toolkit. What can I do with this patient that will help them towards better care? And it's that ability to say, oh, that complexity is what drives me, and I'm good at it. And when I find a solution is meaningful. She came back and was all sparked and ignited after that interview because that was it.
It's interesting. Of course, the message to physicians here is not necessarily that different than the message the physicians are taking to their patients in taking better care of themselves.
Oh, absolutely. And I think you're hitting on a very important point that we need to create a philosophy and approach of wellness for our patients and our providers and our physicians and caretakers. And we're not so different from our patients.
Your point is well taken. It is exactly a national phenomenon. The Institute of Medicine, now renamed the National Academies of Medicine, has a national focus now on resiliency and well-being across all the healthcare care professions. And it's two issues. It's the personal side, all those skill sets that we've been talking about, and it's the how do we change the systems in which people work, which is going to take some time.
There's also great examples from community engagement literature or methodology that I think we can apply to ourselves. And that's certainly one of the things that we try to do with the Triumph students is help to teach them both how they apply some of these processes to both their when engaging with communities and community projects as well as with themselves. And those are things like something that's called asset-based community development, where you're really, rather than focusing on the deficits in an area, you're focusing on what are the resources you have there and how can you lift those up and enhance those. So another way to think about that is rather than saying the cup is half empty, it's half full. And then how do you fill it more, basically? And then the other thing that we teach, and also I found it personally very helpful in my own practice, has been something that we learned with a training from the Milwaukee Public Allies, which is a technique called celebration, discovery, intention, and action. And in that, you're looking at whatever your project is or your goal and saying, okay, what's gone really well? What can I celebrate here? What have I learned in this process? And probably there's something a little bit uncomfortable in that. And what do I intend? What do I want to change about that? And what's the actual action that I'm going to take to reach that goal? And I think that personally, as a Triumph student, that was those were both two of the best lessons I walked away with. And those are certainly things we continue to try to teach the residents as well as the students.
Yeah, we are part of a national organization called the Alliance of Independent Academic Medical Centers. And that has 30 organizations like Aurora Healthcare throughout the country with residency programs that are all participating in how do you design initiatives to support well-being and resilience among physicians. And we have four teams, family medicine, internal medicine, OBGYN, and radiology, who are all part of this larger national community. And what they attest is coming together even in their own teams locally and then going to nationally and finding others creates this kind of community of practice of a shared esprit de corps.
It strikes me that it sounds like a very, very much a glass is half full kind of study. You were looking at what causes people to stay and not specifically at what causes people to leave.
Yes. That was one of the questions I had with Deb early on before we did this study was we talk about burnout, loss of retention, lack of recruitment. And I was saying, but where's our asset-based community development? Where are our positive factors that help us identify what does work? And it was exactly with that intention that we kind of set out on doing this study.
Well, Ann Getson and Sherstie Knox and Deb Simpson, thank you all so much for your time. And again, best of luck in your work.
Thank you.
Ann Getson and Sherstie Knox are physicians with the Aurora Family Medicine Residency Program, and Deb Simpson is director of the Medical Education Program for Aurora Healthcare.
Getson and Simpson authored an article on sustaining family physicians in urban underserved settings that appeared in the Journal of the Society of Teachers of Family Medicine. You'll find a link at WUWM.com.
Coming up after a break, environmental reporter Susan Bentz answers another listener query on Beats Me. That's when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North.
I'm Susan Bentz. Today we hear the next installment of our Beats Me series. It's your chance to ask questions related to education or the environment. Now it's the environment's turn. Our question comes courtesy of Deb Shampers.
I live in Bayview for 24 years, and I have gone over the Hone Bridge to get to various jobs, and all of a sudden this wind turbine pops up, and I don't know what it's about and who put it there and Why is there only one and what is it doing?
Just for fun, during her daily commutes, Champers came up with her own answers.
Such as, I thought, well, based on where it's situated, it's either heating the ovens at DeMarini's.
That's a pizza place a half mile from the turbine, which, by the way, is at the south end of the Hone Bridge, just a hop, skip, and jump from Lake Michigan. Deb sadly was unable to join in the investigation, so I promised to report back.
I'll get back to you.
Please do.
The story takes us back almost exactly 6 years, February 2012, when Randy Faller, based out of Random Lake, Wisconsin, was installing the turbine. Two members of his crew were at work, 150 feet up in the air.
We have 20 bolts holding the rotor hub on up there, and they're torquing those bolts down right now by hand.
Faller is a renewable energy advocate through and through, and he was clearly wowed.
One of the most exciting parts about this project was the tower was made by Bassett Mechanical in Kaukauna, Wisconsin.
While the turbine company is based in Vermont, a dozen Wisconsin companies had a hand in the project, from manufacturing components to testing. In Waukesha, a family business called ThermTech heat-treated one piece of the turbine. Steve Weiberg guides me to one of ThermTech's giant ovens.
This particular project, the main shaft.
The shaft connects the turbine's three gigantic blades to the generator.
We loaded it into one of our main hardening furnaces, this one, actually. It was probably in there for about 4 hours from start to finish, and we pull it out hot. At 1,550 degrees Fahrenheit.
Weiberg says if the shaft isn't treated just right, it could crack. Back at Turbine Central, inside the Port Administration Building, Harbor Engineer Larry Sullivan doesn't have to worry about the shaft or any other turbine part in particular. The system is hooked up to software that allows Sullivan to monitor the turbine's performance with a mere click on a computer keyboard.
It's telling us that the wind speed in meters per second is 5.5 meters per second, and it's generating about 25 kilowatts.
The turbine company in Vermont keeps tabs remotely, and here in Wisconsin, Randy Faller, the fellow who installed the turbine, gives it annual checkups. The turbine produces enough energy to power the two-story port building, a $20,000 a year value. Any extra energy is sold back to the local utility, We Energies. Eric Schambarger with the City of Milwaukee's Environmental Collaboration Office admits it took time to convince people the turbine was a good idea.
So one of the concerns we had from neighbors was, would it be loud? Would it just, you know, be disruptive to the neighborhood? And we're outside here down by 794 looking at the wind turbine. If you pause to listen, you can hear the traffic from the freeway, but you really can't hear the wind turbine.
Schambarger answers one of Deb Schamper's yet unanswered questions.
Are there plans to build more?
The short answer, says Schambarger, is no. This $600,000 project was funded largely by a special fund, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. It was designed to spur renewable energy projects and jobs. That opportunity isn't likely to repeat itself, at least not in the foreseeable future. So Schambarger says the city has its eye on installing solar.
Right now, the city on its building spends about $4 million every year on energy. We spend, you know, several more million on our waterworks and then for streetlights. So we have a fair amount of money we are spending on our energy bills. And so that's what we're kind of, you know, working through the details of how we can finance and install solar in an affordable way on our city buildings.
Let's cover what's important together. Submit your question about education or the environment in southeastern Wisconsin online at wuwm.com/beatsme. You ask, and we report.
It is Lincoln's birthday. We'll forgive you if you have forgotten that. We'll learn more about the 16th president when Lake Effect continues right after this on Milwaukee's NPR.
We're back with Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Journalist Sidney Blumenthal's name is most often associated with one president of the recent past. Blumenthal is a longtime friend, associate, and confidant to President Bill Clinton. He was also an advisor to Hillary Clinton in her 2008 presidential campaign.
But if you ask Sidney Blumenthal, the chief executive he's most obsessed with is not the 42nd president, but the 16th. And as today marks the 209th birthday of our 16th president, we thought it was a good time time to revisit our interview about Blumenthal's book, A Self-Made Man, The Political Life of Abraham Lincoln, 1809 to 1849.
Blumenthal spoke about Lincoln and his career before the White House at an event in 2016 at the Civil War Museum in Kenosha, and that's where Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski caught up with him. He explained then he's been obsessed with Lincoln since a childhood visit he made to Springfield.
I grew up in Chicago. My grandmother's first cousin was a traveling salesman, and he and his daughter, who was a little older than me, went down to Springfield, and I saw the shrines, I saw the sites, and it helped inspire a sense of American history in me. And I've always been interested in Lincoln, having grown up in Illinois. Lincoln's always around. He's ubiquitous. But more than that, he has represented the kind of political values that I aspired to. I always have had a picture of Lincoln in my room, and I hung one in the White House when I worked there with President Clinton. Lincoln, to me, also is a way into understanding the history of our country, the roots of our problems, and how a political leader who rises from virtually nothing learns the skills of politics, becomes the man we now recognize as Abraham Lincoln, then becomes the great emancipator. And it's not simply that it's a great story. It's a question of how does this happen and what are the great issues that he's involved with that still illuminate our predicaments today.
Out of the hundreds of books already out about Lincoln, because many people share your curiosity and obsession with him, what do you touch upon in this first book that you felt other books didn't cover sufficiently, and what makes yours different?
This is the political life of Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln is usually thought of as that monumental figure in white alabaster on the Independence Mall. He's looming above us. We can't even touch his shoes. But actually, he was a real man. And he started out as somebody who was poorly educated, a stunted boy who felt that his father had oppressed him, who set off on his own at the age of 21 without his family, and turned himself into an educated person, a reader, and from the earliest age, constantly running for political office. And he gained those skills through trial and error in the smallest places, from the back rooms of country stores where he debated the issues after hours to literally standing on tree stumps and reciting speeches and debating people. All those lessons that he learned, he applied as president. And this takes Lincoln in ways that I found in my research were highly unusual. From his earliest days as a young leader in his 20s, as the floor leader of the Whig Party in the Illinois legislature, known as a slasher because of his sarcastic cutting style against opponents, to a rival of Stephen A. Douglas, literally 25 years before we think of their great debates in their Senate race, constantly measuring himself against Douglas, the little giant who was, in fact, the greater man who rose higher than Lincoln. Lincoln was envious of him through his marriage to an upper-class Southern woman who was also the most political woman he knew, and her family disapproved of the marriage, to somebody who gets engaged in all kinds of strange events that we don't think of, like the Illinois Mormon War that results in the death of the Mormon prophet, Joseph Smith, which was really part of the Lincoln-Douglas rivalry over which party would control the state because the Mormons were the swing vote. So all along the way, we see Lincoln developing that way, and also against the background of the country as the issue of slavery comes more and more to the fore, and the circumstances change around him.
One famous statement Lincoln made in a speech was, "I used to be a slave." So what was Lincoln's childhood and growth like that he identified with being a slave?
I found that to be an extraordinary statement of Lincoln's. Lincoln first made the statement, "I used to be a slave," in 1856 when he assumed his new political identity is a member of a new political party that he helped create in Illinois, the Republican Party. Lincoln said, "I used to be a slave," and it meant something deeply personal to him, and it goes to the heart of his politics and what he would become and how he would grapple with the issue of slavery. His father, Thomas Lincoln, was a semi-literate dirt farmer who lived in Kentucky and had to compete for wages against slaves. And he fled Kentucky to get away from that situation. He was never very successful as a dirt farmer. The family moved around to different farms. Eventually they came into Illinois. Lincoln, as a boy, was rented out by his father as a wage laborer, and his father took his wages until the age of 21, which was legally permissible at the time. He was, in effect, an indentured servant. He had a difficult relationship with his father. His father did not want Lincoln to read. He considered that a waste of time, a form of laziness, and a distraction from learning a trade by which he would advance in the world. And Lincoln had a different sense of his own ambition and a curiosity and had a very active mind. He wandered around southern Indiana as a boy, finding all sorts of interesting older men who were lawyers, many of them anti-slavery, who had libraries, and he would read his way through the libraries. So for Lincoln, when he said, "I used to be a slave," it was several things at once. One of them was, after becoming a Republican, he felt that he could begin to talk about himself in public. He was very reticent and reluctant to disclose his personal life because he felt humiliated and a sense of social inferiority about coming from such a low class. It also meant that he had risen above it. He joked. He said, "Now they let me practice law, I'd become a lawyer." It was a joke, but it wasn't a joke. Lincoln had, by his own means, emancipated himself.
In your book, you state the lawyer was a politician and the politician was a lawyer. Do you think tools gained as a lawyer become more valuable as a politician compared to other people who ran for office?
Well, Lincoln was highly unusual. Lincoln was constantly working on himself and trying to sharpen how he might persuade people. And what he did as a lawyer in working his cases, mostly before juries, mostly very small cases, enabled him to have a very good sense of the public. But he also had to learn how to make an argument. And one of his fellow lawyers describes a scene on the circuit as they're all sharing rooms and sleeping in the beds by candlelight, of Lincoln staying up late, reading through the books of Euclid in order to learn geometry. He wanted to master it, and he wanted to do it for a practical reason. He wanted to learn logic, and he wanted to learn how to best make an argument.
You mentioned he apprenticed with various people throughout the circuit, but he also had two political idols in Henry Clay and John Quincy Adams. Did Lincoln see these two men, John Quincy Adams and Henry Clay, as father figures that he truly desired? And how did he model himself after these men?
I have a whole chapter on John Quincy Adams and John C. Calhoun, and in a way American politics derives from the conflict between them. Quincy Adams developed the entire idea of what would be constitutional in order to have emancipation. And he figured it would require the war powers of the president, that it could not be done under any other circumstances. When Lincoln was elected president, one of those who had succeeded to the mantle of John Quincy Adams from Massachusetts, Charles Sumner, the senator from Massachusetts, came to visit Lincoln and told him, "This is what Quincy Adams believed." And eventually, Lincoln used exactly that logic, and he was always looking for logic, to apply the war powers of the president to achieve emancipation. So Quincy Adams had great influence on him. Now, Henry Clay is a different matter. Mm-hmm. Henry Clay was Lincoln's beau ideal. Henry Clay is the man who invented the phrase, a self-made man. He applied it to himself. He had risen from rags to literally riches, very wealthy man in Lexington, Kentucky, and one of the most powerful and influential politicians of his day. He was Speaker of the House, he was a senator, he was Secretary of State, and he had run for president, and people thought he should be president. Lincoln, he was a founder of the Whig Party, which Lincoln really grew up in and became a stalwart member of. But there came a time when, because Clay had been so burdened by the politics of his past and so many incidents that had brought him down and caused him to lose elections, that Lincoln would not support his candidacy in Illinois for the presidency at certain key moments. Eventually, he met Clay, who was known to the family of Mary Todd. Mary Todd's father was his business partner and political ally in Lexington. And Lincoln's meeting with Clay was a big disappointment to him. Clay was the great man, cool and condescending to this obscure politician just elected to the Congress on his way to Washington, passing through Kentucky. And yet, Clay still remained a larger-than-life figure for Lincoln, and from whom he drew many lessons, and always referred to him and his politics, and was very conscious also of transcending Clay.
As you mentioned, Lincoln was smart and observant, and he gained and worked his way through the top through knowledge of other politicians and the issues of the day, and used sarcasm and ridicule versus losing his cool, and was quite humorous in his speeches, which I think would surprise a lot of people. But what do you think of the political atmosphere today, and is it so different from what he abstained from?
One of the biggest challenges that Lincoln faced over the course of his life was dealing with Stephen A. Douglas, who's a lost figure to us. We think of them as, you know, two bookends, the little giant and the tall Lincoln, and they debated, and we don't really read those debates and see what's in them. But here's what Lincoln thought about Douglas. Douglas was a demagogue. Douglas used non sequiturs. Douglas was clever. He was sharp. He was educated. He was illogical. He was unfair. He was ruthless. And he wanted to stomp his opponents into dust. And dealing with Douglas was a very difficult thing for Lincoln. How do you deal with his illogic, his unreason, by which he stirs people up against you? Lincoln had to figure out his arguments to defeat Douglas. So it's not as if Lincoln didn't deal with demagogy in his own day. He dealt with the greatest demagogues of the age. And in fact, Stephen A. Douglas was a far more effective, potent, and skilled demagogue than the ones on the stage today in our contemporary politics. And Lincoln had to cope with him, as well as many of the Southerners who were also great demagogues.
As you've researched this book and as you were writing it and continue thinking about your next installments, did you discover anything about Lincoln that you had not known or something that reaffirmed your admiration of him? Or vice versa, was there anything you discovered that surprised you or maybe changed your view of him at all?
My attachment and admiration of Lincoln has only grown as I've done more and more research. Sometimes when you study a great figure of the past, you learn that they had feet of clay. And certainly Lincoln had his flaws and his foibles, and he did embarrassing things. I discovered that he did clownish things, that he did foolish things. But what I also discovered was that he was always developing, always internally working on himself, and that he was constantly trying to not only turn himself into the man he wished to be, but connected to eventually the larger issues of the day. And Lincoln's being self-made is not separate from being self-made in relationship to the issue of slavery. And so following that all the way through, to me, was something of a revelation, because it begins in the beginning, where Lincoln said he was naturally anti-slavery, something that creates a much broader understanding of Lincoln than I had before.
And as you've been traveling around promoting this book and even living and working in Washington, D.C., what's your favorite tribute to him?
It's a good question. Well, in Washington, of course, there's the Lincoln Memorial. And sometimes when I have out-of-town guests, what I like to do is take them there at night where it's all lit up and you can see the monuments from that vantage point. You know, I live in a neighborhood of Washington called Glover Park, and it's just north of Georgetown. And I find that there are all kinds of hidden things around me where I live. I live a block away from a cemetery that we have discovered only recently contains the unmarked graves of hundreds of former slaves. We have discovered that what is an apartment complex just a couple blocks from us, totally nondescript, was something called Wilberforce Village. It was a village of freemen or freed slaves. So Lincoln's Washington is still very visible. If you know the history, it's not gone.
Well, I'm sure your book is added to the tributes to Lincoln that we have today, and I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you very much.
Sidney Blumenthal's book is called A Self-Made Man, The Political Life of Abraham Lincoln, 1809 to 1849. Blumenthal is a former advisor to President Bill Clinton, and he was Hillary Clinton's 2008 presidential campaign advisor. He spoke with Audrey Nowakowski in 2016, and our interview with him first aired then.
We will take one last break, and then Melinda Myers joins us to encourage us to jumpstart the growing season even as more snow piles up in our backyard. It's Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. There is a foot of snow on the ground, and that's not even counting where we've piled the stuff that we've shoveled. So you might think you're off the hook for preparing your garden, but our gardening contributor says, not so fast.
If you are especially motivated to add some non-monetary green to your life, mid-February is not too early to get going. Melinda Myers joins us in the studio now. It is great to see you.
Hey, it's great to be here, and it's always good to talk gardening, especially during the winter.
Well, for sure, because we're into the middle of February and the novelty of snow and cold temperatures especially has kind of worn off at this
point.
Right,
and we just keep seeing more snow and more cold coming. So there are things we can do to jumpstart the season and warm up that green thumb for spring ahead.
Well, and that's kind of amazing to think about when you really can't see the ground out there. So let's talk about this. Let's start from the beginning. What can you grow inside that will then be able to take root once the ground thaws?
You know, if you like the challenge of starting plants from seeds, all you really need is a sunny window, some quality potting mix or a seed starter mix, and then some seeds. And I like to recycle containers, you know, yogurt cups, applesauce, drill holes in the bottom, clean them up, fill them up, and plant them. And you can grow those in a good sunny window or under lights. You'll have greater success if you grow them under artificial lights. But basically, look at the back of the seed packet, and it will tell you how many weeks before the last spring frost, and we're all guessing when that will be, that you start them indoors. So
right,
that's
part of the issue here is you don't want them to get too big when they're still indoors because...
Then you've got these long, leggy plants with weak stems, and it's more of a shock to the plant as you transition it outdoors. So you really want to time that right. We used to think bigger was better, and we'd start our tomatoes early. And they did some research and found really starting them in early April was as early as you needed to go. You'd have good size plants that would adjust to the new location, and smaller plants actually do adjust to the outdoors better than those big, tall, floppy ones.
So right now, in the middle of February, we can talk about wanting to start these indoors, but we really probably shouldn't put them into our containers too early.
Correct. Onions, the end of February, that's one of the early ones. And patience and begonias, very tiny seeds, those you start earlier. Some of the flowers that take longer from seed to become a transplant. And then many perennials, too. And then also, I wanted to mention winter sowing. So people who go, I don't have a sunny window, I'm not buying artificial lights, I travel, I don't have time to water these little seedlings, because you do have to keep the soil moist. That's a challenge. And so if you're gone and you don't have someone to take your place, you need to be careful. So winter sowing.
You have brought something along here to demonstrate.
I did, because I thought, you know, on air, how of course we're going to show how to do it. But a couple years ago, I heard some master gardeners in Indiana talk about winter sowing. And I thought, this is great. You take old milk jugs, you cut around so the bottom is about 3 to 4 inches high. You leave part of it attached by the handle.
Right, so you've got kind of a hinge going on here.
Right. I use the Sioux Germination Plus seed starting mix, so it's nice and fine. I brought some seeds for you to pick, because I'm going to send this kid home with you, and you can let us know how it works. You plant your seeds a lot heavier than you would normally, because you're going to divide them out come spring. So you'll plant the seeds, water it well. You're going to close.
By a lot heavier, you mean a denser concentration.
More seeds for this small area. So you wouldn't space them out 5 inches. You'd probably put a dozen seeds in this small milk container. You're going to water it well, close the lid, seal it shut with duct tape. I like to label mine inside and out, because with the weather, you know, even those permanent markers aren't so permanent. You leave the lid off. And here's the reason why: you want snow and water to go in and water. And then you're going to set it outside, believe it or not.
Now, how are these not going to freeze and die within 30 seconds?
Well, especially this winter, right? Well, we're going to start this time of year, we're going to start things like perennials, cool season annuals like pansies, calendulas, snapdragons. And we'll start those now. We'll put them in a sheltered location. Since we've got all this snow, I'd just pile the snow around the base of it. Great insulation. If you put it under an eave, you're going to have to water. So you want to leave it out where snow and water can get to it.
Because the last thing you really want to be thinking about in the middle of February is, water my plants?
Exactly. Everybody's going to think you're crazy, which has some value to it.
They stay away from you there. You don't get as many dings in your car.
Exactly. He's the nut job. And so then when the temperatures start warming up, it'll be time, you know, after the last spring frost, you'll be opening this up, or when it's time to plant your pansy transplants into the garden, and they'll take a light frost, you can lift them out, divide them out, and put them in the garden. Last year, I grew Cosmos, Cheyenne Spirit, Echinacea, some butterfly weed. I had some tomatoes. I'd start the tomatoes a little bit later, and peppers, because they're warm season plants. I'll wait until things warm up a bit, you know, more like the end of March for those. And it's amazing, because you don't need lights. It's less maintenance on your part, and it's fun. I mean, you know, I don't care how long you garden. When something works out, you're like, yay.
So essentially, what we're doing here, is this like creating a tiny greenhouse?
Exactly. It is. It's capturing the humidity and moisture so it doesn't dry out as quickly. It holds the heat in. When we get really cold weather, you could throw a piece of carpet or something over top. But as long as we have this snow, it's great for just insulating basically the bottom level. So that'll help insulate the roots and the seedlings forming. I was amazed. I was kind of skeptical. And I gave it a shot last year and had such great success. I've been saving milk jugs all winter so I can start some plants this spring.
But again, this is better suited to things like perennials. You would want to sow your tomatoes this way.
Not this early. You could do it, but you'd want to wait until things warm up a bit. So more like middle to the end of March, when things are not so brutal, hopefully. So this is time for perennials and cool season plants. Broccoli, Brussels sprouts, cabbage, they can take it a little cooler and germinate in cooler soil temperature. So things that would naturally, one way to do it is, if you have annuals that reseed, that stay in the garden and they pop back on their own, those would be good ones to try this with.
So let me go back for a second to the starting plants from the seeds indoors. You mentioned, you know, they just have to be in a sunny place. What does the temperature really need to be inside? Let's say, I mean, there might be people who have a three-season porch that's not heated.
Good question. So when we're starting plants from seed, when we're trying to get the seeds to sprout, warm temperatures are important. And that's why we're starting cool season things now in the milk jugs. But indoors, put them in a warm spot. I was doing microgreens, and I put them in my closet until they sprouted, because that was the warmest spot. Because when I get them close to the light, it's a little chilly there. Once they're up and growing, they can take those cooler temperatures. So,
do the microgreens not need the natural light, though? Because I assume your closet does not have a lot of access to the sun.
And that that's when they're sprouting, they don't. So as soon as that, you see that green coming through, and that's true with almost all seeds. Very few need light. Lettuce does, but, you know, in a room, regular room like this even, it would sprout. And then put them in that sunny location as soon as the green appears. You're absolutely right. Now, the downside with windows is we have a lot of gray days. It can be very cold along that window or in that three-season porch. So a lot of people with three-season porches will put a little mini greenhouse you can buy or make just a little plastic to trap the heat around it. But sometimes that light intensity is not enough. So supplementing with artificial light also works. Now, my light setup is in the basement. So I sprout things upstairs because it's kind of chilly, and then as soon as I get greenery, I put them under the lights, and then I have good success. But if you've got natural light and space, add some artificial light, you've got everything you need then.
We should mention you are going to be talking about a lot of these kinds of things at the Milwaukee NARE Home Improvement Show. I feel like this is the part of the Tonight Show where they talk about their appearing for three nights at the Sands or whatever. Talk about the kinds of things that that you get to chat with people about at that event.
You know, that's such a fun event, and I feel like that means spring is on its way.
Exactly.
You know, we're out there looking at home improvements and talking gardens.
You can talk about painting without actually having to be out there painting yet.
That's a good way to look at it. I got some of those projects too. So low maintenance, big impact perennial. So one of the things is we all want beautiful gardens, but we're all busy. So I talk about some of those things that are low maintenance, easy to care for, but give you big results. Create a stunning front yard and entryway. You know, sometimes it's just a few little quick fixes that really make you and your guests feel good when you walk in the front door. On Saturday, I'm going to be doing a Calling All Kids family event. We're going to grow microgreens. So I'm bringing containers and seed starting mix and microgreen seeds, and everyone that comes is going to walk home with a little container of microgreens to grow on their countertop.
That they can put in their closet for a little while.
To sprout and then back in that sunny window. And on Sunday, I'll be talking vegetable gardening success. So growing a bountiful garden, no matter your limitations of size, space, time, and money.
It is a really, we're at the aspirational part of gardening season.
It is. It's always great. That planning part is lots of fun. Somebody said they're working on their masterpiece garden for this year. So I think that's what we should all focus on.
It is always great to see you, Melinda Myers. Thanks so much.
You too, Mitch. Thanks.
And we'll see you once things warm up.
You bet.
Melinda Myers is the author of numerous books on gardening, including Month by Month Gardening in Wisconsin. She is our regular gardening contributor, and you can find more information at WUWM.com about her various appearances at the Milwaukee NARE Home Improvement Show that's coming up this weekend. And that is all the time we have today on Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tighe. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning and evening at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect.
It is all right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next.